Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beets. I personally take Super Beets when I need a power boost. It's my favorite product. Super Beets gives me energy and stamina for my busy day. Right now, get a one-month supply free with your first order. Check out the Dr. Hoffman special right now at IntelligentBeets.com. That's IntelligentBeets.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and let's talk about sex. Yeah, that's an important subject, and it's also very germane to our overall well-being and health. And I can't think of a better person to discuss the subject with than sex therapist and author, Dr. Madeline Castellano. She is the author of a book entitled Wanting to Want, which is an exploration of what goes wrong when sex isn't happening. So Dr. Castellano is a psychiatrist, and she's also a certified sex therapist. She has an active practice here in New York City, in Manhattan, where we broadcast from, and she's a good colleague. And she's also written a couple of other books, haven't you, Dr. Castellano?
That's correct. I have. Thanks, Ron. Yes, I wrote also a man's guide to male sexual issues and then a woman's guide to male sexual issues.
Indeed. So, and for our listening audience, you have a website as well?
Yes, thesexmd.com.
Okay.
Where I have a blog, lots of information about sex, sexuality, the psychology of it, as well as the physical aspect of it.
Okay, great. So, let me ask you just up front, how do you get to be a sex therapist, because it's a subspecialty within a subspecialty. First, you trained as a psychiatrist, correct? And then
correct.
you took a subspecialization with additional training in sex therapy. What's that like?
Correct. So for myself, you know, having gone through medical school, I had all of the anatomy and physiology and the endocrinology taught in medical school, and then going through the psychiatric residency, you get training in all forms of therapy. So really for me, it was the added aspect of classical sex therapy, which is training in the Masters and Johnson's model of doing sensate focus, and then really continuing on with just all of the information that there is out there about what's being discovered as far as the sexuality of sex and the physical aspect of sex. But most sex therapists are actually either psychologists or marriage and family counselors or couple therapists that then choose to take on sex therapy as part of what they do in their practice, or some of them just specialize in sex therapy. And for them, I think there's more intense study because they have to get that part about the anatomy, the physiology, to learn about what goes on physically and what can be impacted for sex and sexual dysfunction. So.
Well, clearly there's been an explosion of knowledge in this field because, from time to time I watch the TV program on cable. It's called Masters of Sex. Presumably you've watched that because you may take a professional interest in it. And it's a depiction of Masters and Johnson in the 1950s and what it was like to be a pioneer sex therapist in the 50s when a lot of these subjects were taboo. Homosexuality, masturbation, these were things that, you swept under the rug. And even just the nature of the sexual response was not properly studied or understood.
Right. They were really doing, as you said, pioneering work, mapping out what exactly was happening physiologically when you had sexual arousal. And then they discovered, and they described the sexual arousal, the plateau, the orgasm, and then the resolution phase. And so before that, it was all really conjecture and anecdote what was happening. They actually put it down on paper and gave us a lot to work with.
Right. Kinsey, one of the pioneers in this field, he studied insects with great precision, categorizing thousands and thousands of species of beetles. And then he turned this sort of obsessive, categorizing and study to human sexuality. So he really made it a science once and for all.
And the beautiful thing about Kinsey, too, is that he did such extensive surveying and was so thoughtful to be so inclusive in his questioning that he got a great deal of information that I think most people would not have looked at otherwise. And, I mean, even, I mean, some of the information about homosexuality and that there's gradations of attraction to one sex or the other to give people an idea of the sexual fluidity that happens in individuals. Just wonderful that he was able to first think about all of these questions and then have such extensive surveying of them. So
why, you know, why is sex therapy considered a healing art? Why is it part of an overall health program for people when, you know, it could be, you know, like relegated to a recreational, you know, kind of category? Well, you know, it's like, yeah, it's optional. You know, we'll teach you to have better sex, but, you know, it's not, I mean, can't really call that medical, or can you?
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting, and I'm very happy that you brought this up, because unfortunately, up until now, it has really been thought of just as recreational. And now I think scientists and medicine is starting to understand the connection between sexual activity and your overall health. And the truth is, there's no division between that anatomy, you know, and any other anatomy. It's all connected. So when you're having regular, satisfying sexual activity, it helps regulate your hormones. It helps decrease your stress. It brings down your blood pressure. It helps you connect and bond with your partner. It's even proven to decrease your chance for heart attacks, decrease your chance for dementia. So we're just starting to understand how it really just can't be ignored or put off to the side as just entertainment, although it is very entertaining, and certainly we humans use it as such, but it is intimately connected to our overall health, and that's why it's so important to address.
You know, on the other hand, when we get too medical and prescriptive about sex, it almost becomes like you know, a chore, like, you know, brushing your teeth or, you know, eating kale or something like that. And I remember when Dr. Oz made his famous declaration that that he and his wife had sex, I don't know, whatever it was, three times a week, that, you know, people, some of the people in the audience sort of felt like, oh wow, I'm not up to snuff. I need to, you know, put that on my calendar, as if it were some sort of mandatory health ritual or an ablution that you had to go through. Are you concerned sometimes that emphasis on, quote, optimal sex is making some people feel bad, or, you know, perhaps they're less sexually attuned, or their opportunities are less, shall we say, available?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think at the core of everybody's, you know, inquiry is, am I normal? So everybody really wants to know, just, am I normal? And there's so many things that influence the frequency of sexual activity. And certainly what you do at the beginning of the relationship with a partner may not be what you're doing years into the relationship with a partner, and circumstances of life, you know, your job schedule, and does it match your partner's, or how much sleep are you getting? Do you have
kids? Put a big damper sometimes on that, too.
Exactly. And so many of those things are natural, and they're a normal part of life, but they normally influence the frequency that you're going to be having sexual activity with your partner, or by yourself, both. So I would say that, you know, the Kinsey Institute actually continues to do a lot of research, and they have done studies that show that married couples actually end up having the most amount of sex compared to single people, which I think some single people don't like to hear, but that's the truth.
And maybe a lot of married couples are reassured to hear, because they may be thinking, you know, my sex life is so pedestrian, I wish I was cruising the bars and, you know, picking up dudes or picking up chicks. And, you know, that's not how it works in the single world generally.
Exactly. But on average, married partners end up having sex more often than single. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and from certainly from a nuclear family standpoint, from a religious and spiritual standpoint, it's actually something that helps to forge a bond in a relationship. Some of aspects of the relationship are more partner aspects, you know, expedient aspects of being together, division of labor, but it actually helps to forge a closer bond in a relationship.
Oh, definitely. And that's part of our design, because Not just us, but, you know, other mammals, too. I mean, we have oxytocin released during sexual stimulation, and then a big burst of oxytocin release at the point of orgasm. And oxytocin doesn't last very long in your body. It starts being metabolized within the first few minutes. But oxytocin helps us bond and trust and feel more relaxed with those people that we're close to. And so when we have sex, it really does help us bond with that person. And over time, that creates stronger and stronger relationship. So sex is not just about having fun. It is also about bonding, and that's part of our social and biological design, which is just fascinating to me how it's all intertwined.
Absolutely. So in your book, Wanting to Want, you take what can be termed a functional approach to sex therapy. So explain it. What does that mean, a functional approach?
Absolutely. You know, most people will think, okay, if I have a problem, there must be a medical reason. So it must be hormones or some anatomical problem. And being both a physician and a sex therapist, I really love to point out to people that it's the entirety of what's happening to you that is causing any symptoms you may be having at that moment in time. And symptoms to me aren't necessarily that something is a problem that you have to treat that symptom. And here's where the functional part comes in. I think about the entire picture and think, okay, the symptom is a message that something is happening in your life that needs attention to. And so often it's either about the relationship or about how someone feels about themselves or how much stress they're having. All of those things play into how much pleasure you're going to experience and therefore how much desire continues to be generated in your relationship. So I really want to point out to people that they have to think about all of these different aspects. Yes, their hormones are one part of it, but then their diet is another part of it, and their stress, and how much is that affecting their medical conditions, and then how do they feel about themselves? How much anxiety do they have? What do they think is appropriate to think about sex or not appropriate? Are they feeling guilty about their sexual thoughts? So all of this is just the multidimensional nature of what could be happening to affect your sexual functioning and your desire for sex overall.
Well, there's a holistic dimension to this, I believe, because, you know, actually, I haven't shared this with you, but I've actually been commissioned to write a chapter for a book on integrative sexual health. That's actually the title of the book. And this book's going to come out later, you know, in a year or two. It's not available for a long time. And the chapter is, they actually asked me to write a chapter on macronutrients and sex. So what are you going to say about that? I mean, it's like, okay, do you eat, if you want to have good sex, do you eat meat, or can you be a vegetarian? Or can it, and actually, there are actually studies that look at the relationship between diet and levels of testosterone and sexual performance. So, you know, clearly, there is an implication. You know, one of the things, one of the trick questions is sometimes when I do my radio program, I pose a question as a teaser before we go to a commercial, and I say, a remarkable breakthrough approach to erectile dysfunction. I'll share that with you in just a moment. Then people ponder it. And then when I come back, I come back and I say, a Mediterranean diet, you know, it turns out to be, and gee, I wish it was like a magic pill. And it turns out to be, you know, these elements of healthy diet, exercise, stress reduction, and so on. These do play a role, I mean, to some extent, only to a partial extent, in the functional model towards a successful relationship and sexual performance.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, I'm going to be joining you because I'm also contributing to that book.
Okay, great.
On female sexual chemistry, like the overview of it.
Great.
So yeah, that's fascinating. And yes, you have to think about the diet and how that affects your hormones. And something that I do mention in the book, actually, in the last chapter on the physical aspects of it, is that there are studies that show that estrogen is actually quite important for sexual desire, as well as for the receptiveness of the blood vessels to stimulation. So estrogen actually can increase the nitric oxide response, which allows the blood vessels to open up and the blood to rush in and fill the erectile tissue, and then cause lubrication for women, erection, and, you know, pre-ejaculatory fluid for men. So you have to pay attention to the testosterone, but also the ability to convert it to estrogen. And so, yes, there's so much for us to talk about.
Right. But what's interesting, though, is when it comes to hormones, hormones are important, but they're not the end-all and be-all. So I wish I had a buck for every male patient who we put on testosterone. where it doesn't overcome necessarily their erectile dysfunction or sexual problems, because libido is very complicated. And it's even more complicated in women. And estrogen that may help women have vaginal lubrication or better sexual response doesn't always improve desire or the ability to have orgasm or satisfactory sex.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I speak about in the book is being disconnected from your body.
Yep.
And some of the things that cause disconnection are anxiety or distraction or negative thoughts or even a sense of obligation, which feeds back into anxiety. And I see lots of men in my practice who come in, difficulty with erection, and talk about how they've used Viagra, but then it doesn't work for them, or eventually it doesn't have the same effect because they are so anxious and so distracted and so disconnected that that continues to trigger their fight or flight response, which is the sympathetic nervous system part of your autonomic nervous system. It works directly against arousal, which you need to be relaxed in order for the parasympathetic to really take over. That's the part that's involved in sexual arousal.
So is it possible to be phobic towards sex? I mean, I actually think that element of, you know, for example, in insomnia, some people dread bedtime. They go into the bedroom and you know, their heart rate goes up and they break out in a cold sweat, just the contemplation of sleep, which for a lot of people is a welcome oasis. Are some people sex phobic, just thinking about, you know, for a man, sexual performance, or for a woman submitting to sex? Does this sometimes create a lot of anxiety?
Well, you know, you're speaking to psychiatrists, so when you say the word phobic, I'm going to really take it at its clinical definition. So, yes, there are people that are phobic. Now, when you're phobic, you have a high avoidance pattern, and yes, you can have a tremendous amount of anxiety.
I'm using it probably in a, maybe the more the popular vernacular. You know, like somebody might say, I'm phobic about eating asparagus. Well, not really, but, you know.
So there are definitely people that are phobic about it, and they can't even talk about it, think about it. But I think what you're referring to are those people that have already become conditioned in some way to be anxious about it.
Right.
So perhaps they've heard very negative things growing up about sex, or maybe they've had some bad experience, some experiences that have led to either, manipulation or being put down or being humiliated, and then they learn to be anxious about it. Or maybe they have pain, and until the pain is resolved, or even after the pain is resolved, they continue to be anxious about it because their brain has made an association to that negative aspect with the thought of having sex. And so therefore, when you think about having sex, immediately the brain recalls negative stuff attached to that. And that's where that anxiety plays in and keeps them from just relaxing into that sexual experience.
So how prevalent are these sexual problems? Because, as you said, Kinsey and Masters and Johnson increased our awareness that there are a lot of variations on the theme. But I think people still a little bit of a taboo. They don't like to talk about it. And generally, people who are experiencing sexual difficulties are in isolation, and they think everybody's doing it, everybody's getting it, except me.
Yeah, you know, that's great that you asked that question, because for sexual desire, but again, there's lots of surveys that have been done, and there's wildly differing numbers on this. I mean, there's some studies that say that between 25 to 50% more or less of women will have sexual desire problems sometime in their life, and between like 10 to 20% of men. But then there's other studies that show it's even much higher. So definitely the older you get, the more difficult and the more problematic it becomes. But even young men and women in their 20s can have difficulty with sexual dysfunction and sexual desire. Sometimes 20, 30, 40%, depending on what specifically the difficulty is. So I want everyone to understand that this is not something that you are experiencing all by yourself, that nobody's ever heard of, and that you are the only one. It's actually a very, very common problem.
Right. Well, you know, even though I'm not a sex therapist, I have frank discussions with many of my patients, and many men especially confess very guiltily that they are having some trouble with ED, erectile dysfunction. And, you know, I just smile and say, well, there's nobody who's exempt from that at one time or another in life. And, you know, you know, hearing it from a physician perhaps is reassuring. You know, I think a lot of people are conditioned to expect to perform like their high-performance cars, you know, like pedal to the metal, 400 horsepower. You know, we have a lot of, you know, we get really upset when our computers don't download rapidly enough, and we have a lot of mechanical devices that are our disposal, and when our bodies don't function as we'd like them to, get really bent out of shape.
Well, if you think about the messages that we get from society about sex, they are that sex belongs only to the young. So if you're older, forget about it. We don't talk about it. We don't think about it. We don't want to know, which is an absolute shame because that's when people are having even better sex. But also that it's supposed to be...
Practice makes perfect.
Practice makes perfect. You know, you learn about yourself and you learn about what it's like to interact with another person. So that's... And you have the capacity to just relax and be in the moment rather than be so anxious about how are people judging you. And then...
Gee, I feel sorry for all those young people, those 20-somethings. It must be terrible.
They don't know. They don't know that it gets even better. And then there's the idea that you're supposed to automatically know what to do, especially for men, which I think is, again, this huge pressure that's placed on the men in our society, that you're supposed to know, you're supposed to be an expert at it, and that it's your responsibility for everybody to have a good time. And no, we're not born with the manual. It's not so easy to figure out, especially if you're fumbling in the dark or you've had one or two glasses of, you know, alcohol. And so,
or these days, pot.
Or these days, pot, or God knows a number of other things. So, yes, it's something that practice does make perfect, and having good information, not just what you see on porn, because that's not real.
Well, that's actually a subject I want to take up with you, because this is something that really is part of our sexual environment, is pornography and the free and rapid access to it, especially for young people who never before were bombarded with so much sexual imagery. I think we'll reserve that for part two of our discussion, because we divide these podcasts into two parts. Let's stipulate this is part one of today's discussion about sex. Our guest is Dr. Madeline Castellano, and the book is Wanting to Want. That's an ebook, by the way. It's available how?
It's available on Amazon, and actually starting in February, it should also be available on paperback.
Okay. So either way, and we'll continue our discussion, including a discussion on the societal effects of pornography, an issue that impacts sexual performance and our sexual environment, in just a moment. Please join us for part two of our podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.